Do you guys have the snow day ritual?
I don't understand. What is snow?
Yes, I'm looking at a palm tree as we
can
speak.
Can you repeat the question?
So you guys don't even know what I'm talking about when I say snow day.
No. The closest we ever had to a snow day was somebody went into the mountains once and brought a pickup truck full of snow to the soccer pitch at my school, and we had a snowball fight.
Really?
But that was during school hours, and then we all had to go back to class. That was a California snow day. Like, some very nice person drove away and picked up the snow and brought it back, and then we played with it.
Was this a kid or an adult?
This was an adult. This was the maintenance crew of my grade school.
Oh my God.
That's the best. This is not a rare occurrence in Southern California. People will go drive, fill up a pickup truck, bring it back, and be like, kids will be like, what is this white substance? I've never seen this.
Oh my God. Well, no, well, that's amazing. So here's what happens on the other side of that. We get a snow in the forecast, and the kids do a snow day ritual. And this is supposed to bring about a snow day. You put your pajamas on inside out and backwards. You brush your teeth with the opposite hand, what? Which is harder than it sounds. You flush an ice cube down the toilet.
What?
And you sleep with a spoon under your pillow.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And this is supposed to bring about a snow day.
Wait, why the spoon?
That's the one that stands. The spoon is where
everything
I got.
Else makes a relevant amount of sense. You know, you gotta like, oh, it's opposite day, and oh, the ice cube goes into the sewage system and then into the sky. I kind of missed that part, but the spoon, I'm not quite sure.
It's kind of fun until you stop and realize that you're raising kids to star in the movie A Beautiful Mind.
And this is consistent across children. This is not just a your weird kids thing, Brad. Just checking. I don't know you.
I am willing to bet that if you talk to anybody from the East Coast or the Midwest, and they've got small, you know, school-age children, they will be familiar with the snow day ritual.
Wow.
Wow, that's fascinating.
That is a thing I have never heard of.
I mean, the closest thing that I can think of is having played baseball a lot in my youth. The idea of rally caps, you know, you'd wear a baseball inside out and backwards or something to initiate a rally. Boy, aren't superstitions stupid.
I still remember the one time this snow day ritual worked. And my youngest son, Max, I let him sleep in because it was a snow day. And it was like, this is great. I don't have to go in and wake him up. The worst part of the day for any kid is when the, you know, mom or dad comes in and wakes him up and says it's time to go to school, you know. So I let him sleep in. He wakes up on his own, comes storming downstairs and says, why didn't you wake me up? I said, it's a snow day. He said, exactly. I want to savor every minute.
You can't win.
So by contrast, Brad, the thing that they do for Southern California kids is, at least when I was at school, do you remember those old 1950s instructional videos that would be like, you know, meat, here's why it's important, that kind of stuff,
yeah.
You know, the black and whites. So what they would do for California kids is they would wheel in a little projector, because this was back in the days of like projectors of VHS, that kind of thing. They would wheel it in and they would show us a video called The East Coast, Why Would You Live There? And it was an instructional video about why people make bad choices, and it was fantastic.
They bookended it with those, you know, drinking and driving, scary.
That's right. They made a whole thing of it. Anyway, hi everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics
and making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I am Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon, and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And that's all one word, Comic Lab. Because I stuttered. I want to make sure you got it right. And when you go to patreon.com/comiclab, you're going to find out that we've started posting Patreon-exclusive pro tip episodes just for our $5 backers and up. And you can see the first one. We let it go public so you can hear a little bit and find out what it's like. But after that, they're all going to be exclusives. And if you're a Patreon backer, you're going to get the pro tips.
And here's the best part about it. They're super fun. If you listen to the first one, or if you haven't, Brad taught me about sheathing your drawing hand in last week's episode.
Guys.
Lucy, it was very uncomfortable that Brad, a grown man, kept using the word sheathing to describe his drawing hand.
Real glad I missed that one.
Speaking of this third voice that you're hearing, we are burying the lead on how exciting this episode is because we have a fantastic cartoonist with us who Brad and I both love. Lucy Bellwood, hailing. Where are you hailing from today, by the way? I don't actually know where you're at the moment.
This is a rare month in which you are actually catching me at home in Portland, Oregon.
Nice.
That's right. Because you are an adventure cartoonist. Is that not
that
correct?
That is correct.
Which, by the way, is the most delightful self-description I've ever heard. I think that's fantastic.
I highly recommend that everybody come up with one. Just pick a couple of absurd adjectives, string them together, and it does wonders for your career. It's great. I love it.
But in your case, it's not absurd.
Well, that's true. It is accurate.
The stuff that you've done squarely in my mind fits into adventure. I mean, the longboat sailing, you've done a lot of neat stuff.
Thanks, Brad. It's a nice thing to realize that I've been able to mix the two together and still do, you know, wackadoodle outside stuff that gets me excited and mysteriously also be a cartoonist, which is a very sedentary job. I think that was the one thing that I couldn't reconcile myself to when I got into cartooning. I was like, I don't want to be indoors forever. It turns out that the internet makes a lot of things possible. And one of them is being able to go draw comics on a tall ship or in the middle of the ocean or like wherever there are satellites, which is amazing.
That is amazing. I mean, it's so fun to that's part of the fun of reading you is that sounds weird, reading you.
I mean, they're autobiographical comics. I get what you're saying.
Yeah. But it's the delight of getting to know you and also vicariously sharing in those adventures. So I think Brad's right. You have found, like, I need a self-description that's like soft-bellied cartoonist or something. That's I have nothing in parallel that makes it sound exciting as to what I do. Sitting around cartoonist, that could be a good one for me. But well, here's a fun description because I always like to ask this question. When you are at Thanksgiving and there's a cousin you haven't seen in a long time, how do you describe what you do to them? Why are you giggling, Brad?
I'll let Lucy go first. You just brought up a great memory.
I feel like I don't have this problem because I don't have a lot of cousins. I have very few extended family, and we're English, so we don't celebrate Thanksgiving. Because as my father always says, we have nothing to be thankful for. We lost the colonies.
Still sore over that, isn't it?
I love the fact that an Englishman would refuse to have a slice of turkey because they lost the colonies.
We're also just not a turkey family. We always have roast chicken. So anyway, we crash other people's Thanksgivings and then go around imperiously commanding them to do things for us. And then
that's good.
Very British, yes.
But if I meet somebody, if I meet a friend of my parents who doesn't understand what I do, I do tend to tell it to them straight. It's just that I've kind of resigned myself to people not quite understanding what that is. Most commonly, if I say I'm a cartoonist, people say, for whom? And then I say myself. And that doesn't gel. Nobody understands that.
Yeah.
I think people can understand now that you don't have to draw Garfield to be a cartoonist, but it hasn't extended as far as the notion that you could be independently employed, which is interesting because those same people have often now in this day and age, this marvelous golden era that we live in, have heard of Art Spiegelman and Alison Bechdel, you know, and like the engine of culture is slowly catching up to common perception. But even in those instances, I'm not actually sure how the people I'm talking to would classify those cartoonists if they would say, oh, yeah, Alison Bechdel's a cartoonist for, you know, and then it's like, what? Because she has a book, she's a cartoonist for a publisher. Maybe that's what they're thinking. But it's the independent part that I really have a hard time communicating to people. I can say I travel around and draw comics and, you know, whatever. But they say like, oh, how is that a job? Like, how do you make a living off of that? And then it gets really complicated because I have 18 million revenue streams and like all these weird things that I juggle together to form something that looks kind of like a career. And that takes way too long. And at that point, their eyes have glazed over and they're eating another slice of turkey. And I don't like turkey, so I leave.
I still get asked, what newspaper is it in?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys get that? And it's like, so yeah, once I actually did this, they said, oh, what newspaper is it in? I said, it's the one that you subscribe to. And they said, I don't subscribe to a newspaper. And I said, exactly.
I enjoy that joke too much that it's worth. Oh,
I thought you were going to say the one you subscribe to and then like, you know, fish into their pocket and pull out their smartphone and be like, did I blow your mind?
Well, the one I wonder if it's the nature of living in Los Angeles, but the response I always get when I say at a cocktail party, I'm like, what do you do? Oh, I'm a cartoonist. Oh, what show? That's what I get in LA.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Or the other one is that going to Canada, the border guards, if you say you're a cartoonist, always think you're a stand-up comedian. And then they ask you to tell them a joke.
Oh, really?
Pro tip.
Oh,
have
man.
A joke ready if you're crossing to Canada.
Wow.
Well, that's just good general advice, right?
I mean, yeah.
I think it's time for our public service announcement to Canada. Canada, stay in school.
No, but the reason I was laughing earlier is I was up in Bad Axe for my niece's high school graduation. And so the whole Geiger family was there. And my one uncle, who I do have an uncle, Elmer, and he kind
oh
of,
my God. Yeah.
Sorry, what's the name of this place that you went? Bad Axe?
It's in the, you know how Michigan is shaped like a mitten?
I do.
Right up in the tip of the thumb of Michigan is Bad Axe, Michigan, where I grew up.
Holy heck.
Yeah.
There is a lot to unpack
yeah.
here.
All right.
Bad Axe, Elmer.
I don't want to keep going, but just wanted to.
It's kind of like you go to Lake Wobegon, take a left, and there you are. You
all
know?
Right.
But
you take a turn at 1860, yeah, exactly. And there you are with Uncle exactly. Elmer in Bad Axe.
And Elmer had inherited the farm when Grandpa Geiger died of a
heart. Oh, my God, the farm.
Oh, my God. Oh, I could go into some uncle. He's a absolute delight. He's a great guy. But when you start telling these stories, it literally does sound like you're doing Garrison Keillor. Mm. Grandpa Geiger died. Grandpa Geiger started every day by cracking a raw egg into his beer. Okay. And mysteriously, he died of a heart attack at a young age. And Uncle Elmer inherited the farm because he had to. Right. There was a very large family and he had to step up and that's what he ended up doing for the rest of his life. He never really made it off the farm nor wanted to. It was the perfect life for him. And so we're standing out front in the house and we're talking and everything. And he says, so are you still a cartoonist? And I said, yeah. And his response, facially and verbally, was exactly the same response you give to somebody when they say they found a tumor. It was like,
oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, well, okay. And he said, oh, well, okay. And then turned and walked away. That was the end of the conversation. And I'm just standing there and I just started laughing. My wife was like half a yard away and was watching. And I just like caught her eye and I just bust out laughing because it was the exact same response that if you tell somebody, yeah, it's cancer.
Oh, God.
It was amazing.
Oh, man. In the meantime, Elmer's muttering into the udders that he's currently milking, going, that boy, he ain't right. Don't be right about that boy. I don't know, Lucille. I'm just squirt, squirt, squirt. I just don't ain't right about that boy. Squirt, squirt, squirt. Oh, boy. I should mention, by the way, before we forget, that if you are not familiar with Lucy's wonderful work, her URL is exactly as you would expect it, lucybellwood.com. You can check out everything from Baggy Wrinkles to 100 Demon Dialogues, which you talk about.
Yeah.
But the big thing I wanted to talk about with Lucy to start off today was something that I'm in great admiration about with you, which is your transparency as to how your career is going. Both in terms of emotional successes and failures and financial successes and failures. And I wanted to see what the background for that was, that willingness to be, frankly, helpful to the world in sharing that.
Man, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this recently because last year, the context for this, for listeners who aren't familiar with this project, was that I did the 100-day project in 2016 and then again in 2017. And it is exactly what it sounds like. You draw something or do something creative every day for 100 days. And in 2017, I cataloged a series of conversations with this little creature, which it turns out I've been drawing in sketchbooks of various descriptions since like 2008. I found one recently from 2008,
wow.
Which is nuts. Yeah.
Wow.
And I thought the earliest instance was probably 2012. I had traced it back to a little comic that I'd done, which was closer to what it is now, which is, you know, a small impish black creature that represents all of my self-doubt and anxiety and, you know, imposter syndrome, all that stuff. But I was going through some notes when I was at home over Christmas and found a sketchbook page from a semester that I did in Spain, in Salamanca, and like found this little demon in the corner of a sketchbook. I was like, wait a minute, you don't belong here. You shouldn't be here yet. So 2008 currently, which just goes to show that, you know, sometimes it takes you 9 years to get around to doing something with anything that's in your sketchbook. So don't throw anything out. But I did, so I did a series of conversations with this little character, and over the course of the project, definitely learned that the more vulnerable I was willing to be, the more honest I was about the less than stellar internal conversations that I have with myself. You know, every time there was an entry that I thought like, woof, this one's way too personal. Like everybody is going to hate me now. Or like, everyone's going to know that I'm an imposter now. Those were the entries that people responded to like gangbusters and were coming out of the woodwork saying, oh my God, me too. I thought I was alone, but I'm not. This is great. So that created this understanding that there is a certain kind of power inherent in being willing to open up to each other. And I think a lot of this honestly comes from the environment that I grew up in. My mother, while being English, came to America to train to be a therapist in the 1970s. And my uncle, who came with her, with their mother, became a therapist, you know, and she's been involved in therapy her whole life and raised me with a very sort of emotionally forward kind of framework. And I also grew up in Ojai, California, which is a very artsy, hippie kind of town, famously in the news recently for being almost immolated in the Thomas Fire, and had kind of a miraculous escape. And the schools that I went to when I was growing up were all kind of weird hippie schools. We did a lot of like councils where everybody sits in a circle and you have a talking stick and you like speak and listen from the heart. And you know, it's if anyone's seen the film Easy A, it was filmed in Ojai and takes a kind of caricature view of the people there. And everyone I know who grew up in Ojai who watches the film spends half the time being like, no, come on, it's not like that. It's not that. There's this whole bit about this girl goes to the local high school and one of her friend's parents is like, they go over and the parents are naked in the backyard having like a meditation circle with some chakra crystals or whatever. And I find myself simultaneously going, no, it's not. Well, it's a little like, yeah, okay.
Well, maybe a little.
Just a little bit like that. Yeah, okay, fine. You got me.
They'd be wearing sandals.
Yeah,
come on.
We're not savages here. So yeah. It's an interesting thing to look back on because the older I get and the more work I do, the more I find that I personally am really drawn to stuff that builds on experiences or traits that I picked up early in life. Those kinds of like formative experiences tend to be really enduring for me. And I find they have a lot of bearing on my work. And often the stuff that I'm doing in the present, if I look at it for more than 2 seconds and trace it back, I realize that most of what I'm doing now is like, it's not new. It's almost like the older I get, the older my work gets, if that mm-hmm. makes, or like the further back it goes. Mm-hmm. So I'm drawing from earlier and earlier experiences. And it occurred to me over the course of this project that having grown up in that environment where that sort of sharing was normalized, at least to a moderate degree, you know, I still have the standard human anxiety about opening up and being vulnerable, but I had a lot of opportunity to practice it growing up. And that, I think, has led to a situation where I have slightly more aptitude at it maybe than the average bear, or like more excitement about trying it out. And to other people that can seem like an extreme act of bravery. And for me, it's like, oh, this is kind of how I'm wired, or how I was.
Right.
And I think it's valuable to recognize those things about ourselves, like to think about what is it that makes you unique? Like what are the things that to you seem completely quotidian that to somebody else, they'd be like, wow, that's a superpower. Mm.
Well, to me, it does seem like a superpower because I have to say when I there's a particularly good XOXO talk that I love, but you've shared in a number of different venues over the years. And every time I see you express such openness and sharing, both success and failure wise, I am always so impressed because for lack of a better phrase, I just don't have it in me to be that transparent, or at least right now I don't. Mm-hmm. It's something that I want to work towards because, frankly, I feel like you sharing has, in some respects, called me out on my privilege of keeping it quiet. You know, like, you know, because I like a pepper soaked in olive oil. My life experience is soaked in Irish Catholic guilt. And so like, I don't want to brag about my successes because I feel like that's terrible. Right. And then I feel shame for my failures. So that's terrible. So what I do, and this is my life strategy, is I curl up into a ball and I don't share anything with anybody.
Well, and also you're funny, Dave. You're a funny, charming guy. And that's like, that's the number one coping strategy. Well, not for everybody, but for many people. And I'm even guilty of this, that, you know, if I can make a joke when instead of like saying something that's actually difficult, in the moment, mm-hmm. I will often defer to making the joke because it's like, oh, this is easy. You know, I can get people to like me. I can like skate through on charm when actually being vulnerable is generally a lot scarier. And I'm absolutely still guilty of that. You know, it's like there are moments of clarity where I think like, yes, I'm going to bear everything. But also in my personal life, you know, in my friendships, like I struggle to make deep friendships with people in my immediate life because there's this weird tension between like, oh, I'm really good at being vulnerable on stage in front of 800 people, but like you sit me down across from a friend and are like, okay, be genuine. Like, don't be your public persona, like be a genuine human being. And I still struggle with that. Like, I don't think you're alone in being on that spectrum of, you know, curling up into a ball sometimes and then being like gregarious and funny other times. And it's a weird
Yeah, I think, and maybe the two of you can help me explain this, but I feel like there is a, for me at least, a helpful separation between my work and me such that when I put a comic out on the internet and get, oh, this is terrible, or I don't, yo, you're the worst, or this or that, what's helpful psychologically is that there's a separation between Dave and Ooh. Dave's work. And so I can go, well, they didn't like that yeah. one. Oh, well, I'm still, as a unit, I'm still proud of myself.
Did you arrive at that? Like, was it ever thus? Or did you feel as if you hit a point of evolution in your process where you were like, oh, these are distinct?
No, I think the internet, and Brad can maybe help me clarify this. I think the internet over the last 15 years has helped me clarify that moment. Because I think when I was younger, I used to self-identify with the work, that I was
Absolutely.
The work. And as a survival strategy, which actually turned out to be quite helpful, I would be like, all right, no, that's separate. And if they're judging my work, it's not judging me, and I'm okay, and life is okay, and everything's okay. Because otherwise, you really do curl up into an armadillo ball, and you go, no, I'm never sharing anything
yeah.
again. But so, Brad, don't you think we've gotten better at that since our 20s, that we the separation between ourselves and our work?
It's hard for me to say because I also had a very different arc than either one of you. I spent the first 5 to 10 years praying that somebody would tell me that I sucked. Because it would have meant that I had gotten some response. you guys right. who got responses from readers were killing me. I would put stuff out there and hear crickets, you know. So I really right. didn't. I wasn't getting a whole lot of response for a very long time at all. And so by the time. I got very little negative response, but that's because I was getting very little response in the first place. And by the time I did get the odd significant negative response, I'd been doing this for so long that it kind of rolled off my back, you know.
But to complete that thought, Brad, so you had basically built up a shell. Even without feedback, don't you think? Is that a fair
yeah.
way to describe it?
Yeah.
That you had, or maybe it's better to say that you had become more grounded in your late 20s and 30s so that by the time you did get negative and positive feedback, you were more secure in who you were.
Yeah, and not only that, but I kind of started learning, you know, I learned that people could provide feedback in ways that didn't take a direct route. In other words, I didn't need necessarily an email or a tweet or somebody leaving a message on a chat board or a forum message board. Because what was happening was I would look at my traffic numbers and I saw that people were coming, you know, and I had users that were repeat users and coming back every day and so on and so forth. So I learned to, you know, to take my sense of valuation, I guess, if you will, from that. And so, yeah, that kind of built up my exterior was, you know, okay, I know I have worth. And, you know, I know that what I'm doing is significant. And so, you know, by the time I would get a negative response, I was kind of ready for it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's, yeah.
And I think this ties into the notion of separating, when you're talking about the separation of, like, I always want to say church and state, of like the state of your personal being and the church of your creative practice. Mm-hmm. And the there's also this
man, touche. That was great.
Thank you. The thing I was, oh man, I lost my train of thought because you gave me a compliment and now my brain is
oh no, oh no, work. I'm so sorry. Got it right. Oh, I'll go quiet.
My value is affirmed as a human being. oh no, what I was going to say is that in the creative process, there's generally this piece of wisdom that I still struggle to internalize constantly, that you can't be like, you can't embody the creative spirit and the critic simultaneously. You can't be editing while you write. And this is something you'll see repeated across the board through many, many different creative practices by various practitioners. But, you know, for writers particularly, they'll say that when you're doing that first draft, when your goal is to just get the words on the page, you have to put the editor voice away. Mm-hmm. You have to put the voice in yourself or from your audience that says, is this worth anything? Is this really any good? I mean, that inner critic, right? You need to put it on the shelf and say, you sit down, you'll get your turn, and I just need to get all this out of my head. And then you come back to it, and that's when the inner critic comes out, and you can say, okay, cut this, move that. You know, criticism well deployed is affirmation, because it means that somebody, I mean, let's distinguish between constructive criticism and an asshole on the internet saying, you know, you suck.
Right. No, absolutely.
But someone, I mean, I also, Brad, have been in that position of like, I want someone to tell me how this could be improved.
Yeah.
Because I know that it's not as good as I want it to be. And if people just tell me that it's great, I will believe that they are lying, because internally I am sure that there is room for improvement.
Yeah.
Often is that I really crave constructive, like I want to be challenged. Like I want somebody to tell me how things could be better. Simultaneously, if you share something and in that first flush of like, I finished it, it's out there, and if the first comment you get is from somebody being like, there's a typo, I will fly into an immediate incandescent fury and throw my computer across the room.
I always know when I've done a typo, particularly on Patreon, because when I post it, if I get a comment within the first 5 minutes of making the post, I know it's a typo.
I don't want to say that in a way that
makes it sound like I'm anything less than thrilled than the people that support me on Patreon. But I always get super great comments, positive and negative. But when it happens immediately, I know it's a typo.
Yeah, that somebody just chimes in instantaneously. Well, and I think it's often if I'll like post a new comic that I've been slaving over for weeks, and then, you know, somebody, the first tweet that I get back is someone saying, oh, there's a typo, and they don't say anything else. That's the thing that drives me to a rage, because it's like, you didn't, but what about literally everything else that I just spent the last work doing?
Right.
But the thing that's funny about the internet is that we are, and I also have encouraged people to do this. I'm in this weird state right now because I taught a class at the animation workshop in Denmark 2 years ago, and I'm actually going back there again this spring to teach a different section. But the class was about webcomics and social media and being a cartoonist on the internet. And arguably, as somebody who puts a lot of stock in being transparent, you would think that, you know, my general tack is to say, absolutely share your process, like be transparent, be you, feed the internet machine, you know, put a bunch of stuff out there, always be sharing. And I'm hitting a point now where that's becoming unsustainable, or it's becoming unhelpful to my practice, because if you're sharing everything and getting feedback on everything at a stage when you are just gathering information, like you're trying to be in that state where there's no inner critic, engaging the internet in your practice is kind of a way of letting your inner editor have a hand in the mix. And so I'm entering a stage where it's like, oh, I think I need to actually keep some of this private. Like last year I got really into the notion of keeping secrets and lying to everyone.
I like that as an idea. I'm trying out something new.
It's called lying. It's called, I took up running and I didn't want anyone to know because I have complicated feelings about it. And so I would get up at 6 a.m. and leave the house. I would sneak out on my housemate so that she wouldn't know where I was going.
What?
And I would run quietly in the mornings and come back. And if she happened to be awake when I got home and asked me where I'd been, I'd be like, I took a walk.
Oh my goodness.
Lucy, what's happening? Why is this
it
a thing?
I mean, I stopped running. And now I talk about it all the time. And I'm back to being a schlubby person. No, now I go to yoga all the time and I tell people about it constantly. But it was an interesting experience because it was part of a year. It was the year that my book came out, Baggy Wrinkles came out, my first graphic novel, and I was promoting it constantly. I was like on the internet all the time, sharing everything, that every movement, every photograph, every selfie, every whatever, like all the time. And setting aside whatever personal issue I have with like trying to be strong and being found wanting. There's like childhood baggage there. But just from a practice of claiming something and saying, this is mine, and I'm not going to share it online. But even further than that, I'm not even going to talk about it with anybody. Like, I just want it to exist in the vacuum of my personal experience. Was really transformative.
Was this something was really that you kept secret because you were afraid, like the running? You kept it secret because you were afraid that you weren't going to stick with it, and then that was going to be a failure? Because I can definitely identify with.
Yeah, I think that absolutely plays into it. I think it's also that I know people who take up running and then talk about it incessantly, and I wanted to talk about it. You know, I was proud of myself. I was excited about how it was going. I found myself wanting to talk about it, but it was just an interesting contrast to the way that I live the rest of my life, which is like share everything with everyone all the time, constantly. And I guess it was just a good practice to notice when I wanted to share, what I wanted to share, why I wanted to share it, and to just put it on hold for a little mm-hmm. bit, you know, just for a while. It probably lasted like 6 months, maybe. And weirdly, when I started telling people, I would like tell people in other cities. I went to stay with my friend Katie Shanahan for TCAF, and that was May. So I'd been doing it for a couple months at that point. And I told her, I was like, Katie, I have to tell you something. She was like, yeah, what? And I was like, I've been running. And she said, that's great. do you do that all the time? And I was like, oh shit, this isn't going the way that I thought it was going to go.
I like that. It's so funny how like the idea of basic self-care to be hidden. It's like if I pulled Brad aside at a convention and be like, Brad, last night, After Comic-Con, I ordered a salad. I didn't get a burger.
And he said exactly
Brad,
what Brad's like, said.
Brad, this was a big journey to be able to tell you I ordered a salad. I love that, Lucy. That's delightful. That makes me like you even more.
I'm so glad.
What's great is that you're coming at this from the opposite spectrum, but finding that self-care also involves hiding a little bit now. And I'm coming at it from the other perspective saying, oh man, Lucy's really showing me that maybe I need to share a bit more. And we'll meet in the middle and become Brad's Uncle Elmer going, well, I guess you're going to be a cartoonist.
I guess.
You're an emotionally balanced individual.
That's right. I guess that's a job. Squirt.
But the reason that I am so in ardent admiration of Lucy is that you came out at a very specific point in your own career arc, and it with a very, very transparent, if you watch that XOXO talk in front of a packed auditorium, you came out with some very, very intimate details about your business. And it's something that I don't know that I would be able to do, certainly at that point. But I'm gonna assume. I guess maybe I shouldn't. I'm assuming at 48 I got a few years on you. Am I right?
You are correct. Yeah.
So
you are correct, old man.
So at old, this, old but, at, man. But see, that's what I'm really kind of happy about being 48 is that I've gotten to the point in my life where I can look back and be ruthlessly honest about the failures that I've had. In fact, when I'm talking on Comic Lab or I'm writing on webcomics.com, some of the best topics are how badly I crashed and burned and why that happened and what you might be able to learn from that as somebody who's a little bit younger. Case in point, conventions. You know, my attitude on comic conventions has taken a 180 degree turn, and it's mostly because of my experience of showing up at conventions time and time again and watching tumbleweeds, you know, blow across my table. But see, to do that at 48 is one thing, right? I'm kind of in a certain spot now, and to look at the
Oh, I see. You're saying you're doing it from a point of comfort. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like it's so it feels safe to you because you made it through and you're on the other side. You're in a position of stability. And so you can say, woof, I made some hiccups when I was younger, let me tell you.
Right.
But like now it's okay. Yeah. And arguably to me, I think the further into my career I get, like the more that stability or success builds up around me, there are some ways in which I think for me, it becomes harder. Like it, to me, it seems it was relatively easy to share at that point in my career because I didn't have anything to lose. Like I could talk about my business because it wasn't like, I wasn't big enough yet that people would say like, well, you don't deserve, I mean, the talk was largely about the notion of audiences saying you don't deserve to complain. Like you're living your dream, you're following your bliss, whatever. Like you're making some kind of living at this. So whatever. Or alternately, you're making too much money at this. You shouldn't be allowed to gripe about it, you know, whatever. There's this weird dance. And I think now to me, it's scarier. A lot of the talks that I've been giving or the posts I've been making recently are to do with financial transparency. And I talk with a lot of cartoonist friends who say that the notion of financial transparency gets harder and harder the more successful they become, because we're comfortable saying like, hey, I'm broke.
Yeah,
you know? That's one thing.
Right.
Like, I'm scrappy, but I'm making it is still okay. And then saying like I'm pulling in a middle class family household income, suddenly you're the man, and that becomes complicated. So from a personal failings perspective, you know, or a personal struggles perspective, I totally hear you that I think it does get easier to talk about follies of your youth, you know, or changes that have happened in your perception of say conventions over time, which I absolutely have seen in myself even over the last 6 years. But financially, I'd be curious to hear what your guys' thoughts are, because I think that actually has an inverse relationship. It gets harder.
Well, I would love to jump on that, Brad, first, if you don't mind. I have an interesting thought about that, because as you were saying that, I realized that for me, communicating about success and failure isn't just an emotional response, or rather an emotional hesitation on my part. It's also, I think, a marketing hesitation on my part. And here's what I'm getting at, is that if I say, wow, I'm pulling down a middle income Americana income, this is great, I'm doing great, everybody, hey, everybody, don't worry about Dave Kelly, he's doing great.
But, kids are all right.
But then I say next week, oh God, we're starting a Kickstarter. Oh, hey, that Patreon sure needs your assistance. Like, do you get what I'm getting
Absolutely.
At there? Is
yeah.
that it's tricky to
You don't want people to say,
it.
Oh, it's okay. Tricky to pivot. Like, he's...
Right. So... I guess what I'm saying is, and this might be just a fear of mine, maybe it's unfounded, maybe it's hard for me to countenance the fact that people still might want to give a dollar to my Patreon, even if I'm already doing okay.
Yeah, that's a hard
that
one.
Comes down to a very existential difference in how different people approach both Patreon and Kickstarter. Because when you say that, you're telling me that you look at Patreon as a tip jar, as a charity.
Yes, I guess I do. And a part of my personality might feel that way. Yes, but that's the emotional response. But I'm also saying, as a marketing response, I feel like it's tricky to pivot from having a, like, say, let's say a transparency talk at the next Comic-Con where I'm like, here's exactly what I earned. Here are my costs. Here's my net profits for the year. Here are my cost of goods sold for everything that I sold. And here's where Dave Kellett stands. And then from a marketing perspective, it feels weird to pivot to, and that's why I need your support on Patreon. It just...
Well, I can tell you that from my perspective, you know, Patreon has been a slow growth thing for me, but an enormous boon in that now it covers my basic monthly expenses like rent and food and stuff. And that has been instrumental in being able to take the time to focus on book projects like 100 Demon Dialogues, or, you know, it's like Patreon gave me the bandwidth to not take on freelance jobs so that I could run the Kickstarter. And then having made the books, Patreon's footing the basic bills while I'm marketing that, you know, it's like... The reason that I'm transparent about those finances is that for me, Patreon is kind of a do or die distinction between being able to forge a sustainable career where I'm focusing on projects that I care about and just like being a freelance monkey in the grind all the time. And it's different for everybody, right? Everyone's career has a different ratio of Patreon support to Kickstarter income to, and cost of goods sold is like, I just did my taxes, so I'm like all up in this right now. It's such a weird one because, you know, you're looking at stock that you own, like you just did your Kickstarter this year, Dave, right? Or last year. And, you know, now you've got, how many books did you print?
Which one? Anatomy? I think it was 3,000 or 4,000.
So you've got, you know, some number of thousands left over, right, after the campaign.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I do.
Campaign warehousing.
Lucy, I was having
you're not writing that off. Oh, yeah. It's the best. I love being a publisher. It's great.
I love the dart throw of like, how many do I order? That's always the worst moment of like, I guess it could be this number. Dart throw.
Because I hecked that up with Baggy Wrinkles. I ordered too few, and then I put the book into distribution, and we ran out.
Yeah.
And I had to order more.
The best worst
it
problem.
It was the worst problem because it was like, God, if I had just ordered 4,000 books from the go at the beginning, you know, from the get-go, like I wouldn't be paying all of this money. It would be, I've learned some stuff. I've made some mistakes.
Right.
But the point with the stock is that like you're looking at a future investment, you know, and I guess the problem with talking transparently about finances is that like, Dave, you're also supporting two children, you know, and like living in a major metropolitan area. You do have two kids, right? Am I making that up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I do. Yeah. Well, and Brad.
Okay.
So three.
Three children.
No, I was kidding. Brad is not my child. I was kidding. Sorry. I don't know. That was a half-assed joke. I don't know where that was.
But, you know, it's like there are so many factors at play. Or like for some people, I think this is always really important to talk about if you're talking to students, particularly like some people are dealing with debt. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get out of like art school and you've got $100,000
debt,
like your numbers are going to look really different. So I guess the tricky thing about it is that like I'm always really curious. I'm curious to hear about the people who are doing well and the people who are not doing as well, because the first time I talked to a cartoonist who told me that they had pulled in not net but gross over $100,000 in a year, I was like, "That's that doesn't line up with the starving mm-hmm. artist thing that I was fed growing up." And you know, my parents are both freelancers; they have been my whole life and work in the film industry, which is like very much a feast or famine environment. You know, you can make a fortune, but you can't make a living. And so it's, I was talking to my dad about this a while ago and he said, gosh, you know, I think I've probably pulled in $1 million cumulatively over the course of my career, but those jobs like often came 8 years apart. And so it would be like, kind of like working in publishing, you get an advance and everyone's like, wow, you know, a 6-figure advance. That's so fantastic. You must be set for life. And it's like, well, okay, $100,000. And it takes you, you know, 2 years to write the books that you got that 2-book deal for. And so that's like 50 mm-hmm. grand a year. And, you know, okay, after taxes, that's 30% off of that. You know, you just like winnow it down. And so I think it's less about saying like, look at me, look at how well I'm doing or how poorly I'm doing. But it's about giving other people just like, just some information about the playing field. Because as artists, we're not raised to talk about business. We're not raised to talk about money. And so I didn't know coming into all of this. I had no idea what was normal. It was like, and it turns out there actually is no normal. I know cartoonists who are making, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year. I know cartoonists who are making $5,000 a year. All of them are cartoonists. You know, it doesn't have any bearing on whether or not you're a cartoonist. So you can just put that aside and like not worry about that part and get on with like, how do I make it sustainable for me? And that might mean, you know, it might mean Patreon. It might mean Kickstarter. It might mean doing something completely different. Like, I don't really know, Dave, what you're, if for you, Patreon feels more like a tip jar, is that because you're making more money off of ads for your webcomic? Or is it because you make a lot of money when you manage to go to conventions and like sell a bunch of books? Or, you know, it's different mm-hmm. for everyone. And that's helpful and also frustrating because you can't replicate anybody else's model.
Yeah. But the reason why I personally felt both excited and called out in the best possible way by your transparency is that for the most part, I've actually tried to make a chunk of my career paying it forward and helping other people. Like Brad and I and the guys wrote How to Make Webcomics. We did Webcomics Weekly. I made Stripped as a film, all because I love comics and I wanted there to be resources in the world that I wished I had had when I was 15 to 25, you know? And yet I do feel called out in the best possible way by you because you gave actual numbers, whereas that is still a roadblock for me emotionally. And no, I'm just being honest about it. Is that?
I mean, I would say that, and it wasn't even me. It was David Reese who gave the numbers at EXO. Like, I wanted to do that in my talk, and I didn't have enough time. And then, fortunately, even though he didn't see my talk, David Reese, who's a cartoonist and TV personality, and like does a million different things, but most people would know him for Get Your War On, got up the day after me and said, "You know, I figured I would just try this thing because what the heck? Here's 15 years of freelancing numbers." By the year. And if you haven't watched his talk, I would highly
recommend. Yeah, that was it.
It was great.
That talk was amazing. And especially, it was
helpful
fun.
Because he has 15 years to draw from and I've got like 7, you know, or 6 at the time. And so it's more interesting to see it really spike and dip over the course of a longer time scale.
Yeah, I mean, the best parallel I could give it in terms of being transparent about my numbers is that for me, emotionally, it feels like you saying, "All right, Dave, here's what we need you to do. We just needed you to jog in a goofy way down a street naked for everyone to see, all right? That's all we're asking. Just no clothing at all. And also, don't run normally. You got
to
run goofy.
Take those heels out to the side.
Like, make sure everything's wiggling around there. So that's what we need from you, Dave." And Like a part of me is like, I cannot do that. I can't be transparent about my numbers. It just terrifies me in a way
you've
that
put a lot of thought into this running fantasy. I mean, you have fully actualized it in your mind.
And now you know why I lied about running.
I mean, Lucy, I don't think this is something that he's thought of for the first time just on the mic. I think this is something that's been going on.
Wow. Wow. This is starting to become very accusatory. Here I am trying to open up about my feelings, and here you are, Brad, throwing tar. I do not appreciate this.
Well, Dave, here's a question. Would you, so I understand that it's like a huge leap to say, you know, share these numbers on the internet with everyone. And granted, like, talk about numbers on stage in front of 800 people is still kind of a stretch. But I think it depends on the receptive environment. And I've had conversations with cartoonist friends who were like, I don't even want to talk to my friends about this in private, because arguably for some people, like Steve Lieber has often said that, you know, he won't share his numbers publicly because for him, he's negotiating page rates with, you know, Image or whoever. And like, it removes some of your business power. If you are putting everything out there, and like in some contexts that can be a challenge. For me, being independently financed, you know, or like relying on crowdfunding or my own freelance gigs, like that, there is less at stake for me. So I'm a little more comfortable sharing that stuff. But Steve has always said, like, I won't talk about this all on the internet for everybody to see. But if any aspiring cartoonist comes and asks me at a convention, I will give them the straight answer. And I think that's a good compromise. And that's a question to ask yourself is like, okay, I'm not comfortable sharing this on the internet for everybody. Totally not for everyone. Totally depends on your circumstance. But like, would you be comfortable sitting down with another cartoonist and talking about those numbers?
So first of all, I want to say, Lucy, you're healing. Thank you. And then
I also brought these crystals. I would like you to talk one.
I want to say, having grown up in Southern California, well, I want to say, Lucy, I hear your words and I've internalized them and I thank you for your words. your presence has meaning to me, and I thank you for your presence. Brad, you laugh, but this is how we talk in Southern California sometimes.
And like, it does have value, and also you have to laugh at it.
All of a sudden, flushing ice cubes down the toilet doesn't sound so strange.
Yeah, y'all are normal over there.
Really, the only one that's normal in this entire scenario is Uncle Elmer squirting milk into a pot. No, but to answer Lucy's question, yes, I think if either of you pulled me aside, or if any cartoonist pulled me aside at a convention and be like, so give me the scoop, how did that book actually do for you? Or how did this project actually do for you? And I think, Brad, you and I have actually done that at conventions or and with other friends. We've talked about, like, here's the real scoop. You know, I put a good face on it in a fake it till you make it kind of way. But I lost money on that book and it was painful, or this or that, you know. That.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Lucy, I hear you, Lucy, and I agree with you that would be the path that I should take. Yeah.
Well, now, see, here's one thing that transparency, it really does seem to be kind of like the dividing line for things. And that is, on Patreon, you have the ability to either show your estimated monthly total or per update total, or to hide it. And,
oh, yeah. I want to hear your guys' thoughts about that.
Well, I know, Lucy, you show it.
I do.
Right. And Dave, I haven't looked up yours recently, but I think you hide your numbers.
Well, I did. It's funny you should ask that. I did, up until a week ago, have it public. And then I'm trying hiding it. And
so what prompted that change?
Shame. Shame and guilt. mostly guilt. No, I'll be honest. Okay, so there is a logical and an emotional response to this. The logical response is that I see Zach Wienersmith and Jeff Jacks on Patreon, and they're doing gangbusters, right? Mm-hmm. And I can see with the logical mind that I, as a reader, would still see Zach's numbers and go, you know what? I'm still kicking in $5. I would see Jeff Jacks' number and go, you know what? I'm still kicking in $5.
Oh, my God.
But here's my emotional response. If it was me and I had those numbers, I don't know that I would give to me with those numbers. So it's this is the play that I'm going through in my mind. Is the logical side of me says, if someone loves Drive, they're still going to give to Drive, even if it's doing well. The emotional side of me says, someone is not going to give to Drive if it's self-evidently doing well. So I'm trying hiding the numbers. And I
that's interesting that you would divide that along those lines, because I almost would have reversed it. Like, I would have said the emotional pull is someone had a reaction to this. This, my work elicited a response in somebody. They feel gratitude and they want to close that loop by giving me money, regardless of how I'm doing. The Ferengi take is to say this person is doing fine. They do not need my help. Regardless of whether I've had a positive emotional response to this, I'm not going to bother giving them money, which I have absolutely done.
Really?
So, like, and where is that line? You know, is it $1,000? Is it $5? Is it $8,000? Like, is it $10,000?
This is fascinating to me.
So that it's interesting you put it that way, because I think for me it's reversed. I would describe giving regardless of financial well-being, perceived or real, is an emotional thing, and not giving is a like calculating thing.
Yeah, no, I can see where you're coming from. And I think what my mind does, my mind and heart interplay on this, is that it's all about the external versus the internal. So I can see why someone would give Jeff Jacks money, even though Jeff Jacks is doing well, because there are moments where it's like, I was in a dark, dark place, and your work singularly, even more than my family, my friends, your work carried me through it, which I know is the case with Jeff's stuff. And so here, as thank you, now that I'm in a better place, I want to give you $5 a month to thank you for that, right? And so that's, I can see that both emotionally and logically happening for Jeff. But what happens is, and I think it's insecurity on my part, I can't see it happening for me. Does that make sense? That it's the insecurity that kicks in that then muddies the waters of how that could be translating into my work.
I'm listening to you too, like you're aliens. I come at this from a completely different mindset, and partially I think that's because I'm offering exclusive content on Patreon. So I come at this by I leave my numbers public as a representation of the quality of the exclusive content. In other words, when they see a large number, they're saying, oh my gosh, this must be good because so many people are supporting it.
Right. Well, there's the perceived value thing.
And I wonder whether that wouldn't be the same for you guys who may not be concentrating as much on exclusive rewards, whether that number isn't a selling point that you would think to yourselves, I'm going to leave that public because when people see that there's a lot of support, it shows that I'm worthy of that support, that so many people must support it, it must be a good thing.
No, there's a lot of value in that thought, Brad. Is it the idea that there's the public perception of it is a big thing. And that's why, to Patreon's credit, it's still wise of them to say, do you want to hide your numbers? Okay, but definitely keep showing how many patrons there are. So even if you want to hide the monetary value, you still see the number of people in the room. You're like, wow, 1,000 people. Yeah, that's right. A lot of people back in this thing. You know, that kind of thing.
And that also differs so particularly depending on the creator, that, you know, for some people, it's like you have a relatively small number of people pledging a surprisingly high quantity of dollars, right? Versus some other folks who have, you know, 5,000 patrons, but they're all giving 50 cents. So you're getting $2,500 a month. And like, it just really depends on, I'm just so fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. Like what different kinds of creative practices, you know, bring about from people. And when I look at my Patreon, like I'm not sharing a lot of comics content on there. You know, my comics output is relatively low, but I talk a lot and very transparently about like what's going on in my life or, you know, my day-to-day process, or I'm sharing a lot of personal stuff. And like that can be its own value given thing. I'm actually looking at all these post-it notes that I just put on my ceiling because I haven't really updated my primary Patreon page description since I launched it 3.5 years ago. And so I'm looking at that and thinking like, okay, given what I use Patreon for now, how should I brand this? Like what's the most effective way I can get across, you know, what I'm doing?
Oh, well, you know what? I will share one number with you guys because I'm more comfortable sharing failure. So Drive, I just updated my Patreon, Lucy, after 3 years of not having done anything to it for Drive.
Uh-huh.
And I was a per update, one of the few people still doing a per update comic model rather than a per month. And so what that meant is every time a Drive comic page went up, people would pledge 25 cents, 50 cents, a dollar. Some of them were grandfathered in.
Right. And how often do you update a month?
8 times a month. And it turned what was inarguably a hobby side strip into the better part of my career. It became the main chunk of my career solely because of Patreon. That gave me the confidence to kickstart the book, which was a big success. And that was great. But I said, you know what? This is getting too complicated. People are putting governors on their giving, you know, minimums and maximums, that kind of stuff. Right. Some people are being kind of waved off of it because they're like, wait, I'm pledging a dollar, but as they, what if you update 20 times? I'm scared that's going to happen. So it, I just said, you know what? We're going to go to the per month model. Mm-hmm. That's the new normal on Patreon. And in so doing, the first month, I'm down $1,000.
Woof.
So I'm panicking right now. I'm just kidding. So I Patreon has assured me that in the longer term, it is actually a growth model because for all the reasons that I elucidated, mm-hmm. people find it easier to say, I'm giving a flat $2. That's all I got to think about. Yeah. No big deal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so interested to hear that you did that because I have a couple of friends who have been charging per update and I have been harping on them. I'm like, change. Like, I know it's going to be a hit the first couple of months, but like, I think it's ultimately going to be better for you because you're going to have more people giving more consistently. And it also, I think, frees you up to make different creative choices because if you're trapped in a scenario where you only get paid if the comic updates, I mean, it's a great motivator. Don't get me wrong, but like there has been something really different for me about having a monthly model where I know that there's just a batch of people who want me to continue existing. It's right. less about like we are paying for this specific deliverable that you're giving us. That's kind of what Kickstarter's for. And on Patreon, it's like we're here for like the months where you're just staring at the wall, picking your belly button and like thinking about life because we know that 4 months down the line, that's probably going to turn into something that might be interesting yeah. or relevant. And that's been really, I mean, that's more of like my personal philosophy of what Patreon does for me, right? Like your mileage may vary, but I would love to talk to you more about this maybe off the record because that might, you know, we're running out of time, but also it might be more personal. But I would love to hear what that has been like for you and like how you pitched it to your readers, because I think that's also a really important component is to be transparent enough to say, hey, this is how things work currently and it's working out real well for me, but like I want to make this leap, kind of like the big Patreon fee kerfuffle that happened where mm-hmm. there were some people who canceled their pledges, but there were some people that trebled them because they said like, oh, you're going to penalize me for giving you a small amount of money? Okay, I'll just give you more money.
Right, like, right.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I'll take that. Yeah, so for me, the good news in this scenario is that I made absolutely sure that I was comfortable with the decision before I did it. I'm still comfortable with it. And I pitched it as, look, basically this is just bringing simplicity to your involvement with Drive, Drive's involvement with you, and my involvement with Patreon. So I, for yeah. all the reasons that I laid out for my readers, I was actually really comfortable that the change occurred. And I still think there's going to be a net positive 6 months out. Like if yeah. we check back in on it, I bet it'll be fine.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it's not terrifying right now.
Yeah, I think the most operative thing that happened is what I like to call the gym membership effect, which is that a lot of people, because of my updates and because of Patreon's separate and individual updates to everyone that is a patron of mine, basically a lot of people went, oh God, I'm still a member of that gym. I haven't gone in a year. Oh God, I'm still a member of that gym. I forgot how expensive that was. And so and maybe it's okay because I had basically gotten rid of some cruft of people who were very kind-hearted, but either whose financial situation had changed and they hadn't realized they were still giving, or who had given a lot and then took a hard look at that number and went, that's enough for Dave.
I
think that
I am always flabbergasted by that. Yeah, when it shows you on somebody's patronage stats that it's like this person, you know, is giving you $2 a month, but cumulatively has paid you $400 yeah. because they've been here since the beginning. It's like, wow, this is like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't think about it in those terms. I just think like, oh, I give my friend $2 a month, but I find it very moving. I don't know the whole, like I can get very touchy feely about all of this because I think it's kind of magical, but there's also the part of my brain that the Ferengi part that's very focused on, you know, practicalities and business and marketing and strategy and how are we going to get those numbers up? It's Q1. We got up. It's Q4 kind of technically still, but yeah.
To that end, this is something that came up when you were talking about the fact that Lucy, your Patreon is more access to you. Do you find yes. if that is the case that you would get positively reinforced for pulling back on social media and funneling that to Patreon where you're getting paid for?
Yeah, I hear you. I think Patreon is the place that I have continued to update even when things are difficult. And that is kind of because, I mean, in the same way that speaking at XO was not as much of a challenge as it might have been speaking at a different conference, because it is a conference that is explicitly about the challenges and particularities of being an independent creator in the internet era, like that room was full of people who were really they were there for it, you know, and they were unlikely to start throwing vegetables. And that earlier in the day, like somebody had given a talk, Samus, the rapper, gave a talk about crying on stage while she was performing and how it had changed her creative practice and like how potent it was for her. And seeing her talk made me more comfortable about the fact that I was on the verge of tears for a lot of my talk. Or seeing David Reese talk was like, oh, we're all doing this, you know, like it's not, we're enabling each other. So on Patreon, I think because I've tried to be really clear from the start that I am building a space where I can be a little bit less guarded. I'm, again, this goes back to that sort of question of superpowers, is like people look at my public persona on the internet and think it's pretty genuine. And the more I do this, the more I come to realize that it's not. I mean, no person on social media is a whole person, right? We can't accurately depict every corner of our psyches and abilities and whatever. Even if you go to see a flipping therapist, like the therapist only knows your side of the story and they only know what you have time to tell them, which at an hour a week is like, you know, not really enough to get a whole picture of you as a human being. And like, how can you ever really communicate your lived experience to another oh God, like it just all gets really intense. But on Patreon, I have deliberately put effort towards building a space where people are clued into the fact that if they show up for Patreon, they're showing up for the stuff that's maybe not as polished, that's maybe a little more rambly, that's maybe a little more personal, that's maybe not always super positive and peppy. But you also get to see how the sausage gets made. And so I think that you're totally right. I have pulled back from other outlets, but I am trying to channel more space into Patreon because it's astonishing what it will do for you mentally if you are connecting that type of sharing with financial remuneration. And Patreon's the place where I see that most directly. And the hard thing about being an indie creator and a self-publisher the rest of the time is that the metrics are all over the place, right? Brad, you're talking about like you can see the numbers of people coming to your website and repeat visitors. And for me, like I get sales numbers from my distributor. I kind of get traffic to my website, but I don't really put a lot of stuff up on my personal webpage. You know, it's like a portal for people to go view my comics, but I don't blog there very much anymore. And I get Patreon stats and stuff, but it's, you never know if someone looks at a blog post of yours and then like 4 years later buys your book, there's no map that connects that. So at least on Patreon, it's like, I give you this stuff, you give me some money, hucha, 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 career. You know, like, it all works out somehow.
I appreciate hucha, hucha, hucha. That describes my creative process. Hucha, hucha, hucha. That's great. Well, I got to tell you, we're over an hour now, and we didn't even get to talk about the thing that I was most looking forward to talking with both of you today, which was if you could bottle 5 minutes of your process, the most joy-filled 5 minutes, all the endorphins firing, what would it be? But maybe, Lucy, if you're willing, we'll roll that into the separate pro tips recording that we're going to do for our Patreon backers.
Let's do it. Hey, if you want to become a backer on Patreon, you should probably go to patreon.com/comiclab. And
Oh my God. This Lucy Bellwood.
So you can access that sweet, sweet content that we're about to deliver.
Wow. Someone is good at many things, Brad. We are in the presence of a polymath. Yes.
Well, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And this week's very special guest has been the wonderful Lucy Bellwood, and you can check out her first portal to her Patreon, to Baggy Wrinkles and 100 Demon Dialogues at lucybellwood.com. And of course, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. Hey, listen, if you go over to Patreon, you're going to, you know, probably get tempted into making a pledge. If you don't want to do that, you can still support the podcast. Just go over to iTunes, give us a 5-star review. It isn't going to cost you a thing, and it's going to put smiles on 3 faces right here.